Welcome to Put Simply, the podcast that puts what's happening in the world simply without compromising on the details. Erdem Koch is my name, Rodney McCune and Ozan Ibrahim, my co-hosts. Gents, good to be back with you both.
Hello there.
Hi, guys.
Well, a monumental moment for the Middle East. At least that's how it's been touted by US President Donald Trump, who says that Israel and Hamas have agreed to the first phase of the Gaza peace deal, which is hopefully paving the way for a ceasefire. It comes, of course, just over 2 years after that deadly attack by Hamas on Israeli soil, killing 1,200 people, taking 250 people hostage. And then the story that has long been told, what we've all witnessed in the last 2 years, the brutal onslaught onto the people of Gaza, killing by official reports somewhere in the vicinity of 70,000, of course, unofficially, probably much, much more. And the devastation that has been caused as a result of all of that has been heartbreaking to watch over the last 2 years. Rodney, take us through the elements of this peace plan. What is it and where does it go? Where is it, I guess, taken from here on in?
Well, look, I think it's maybe exaggerated to call it a peace agreement or a peace plan. I think really what we've got is a platform for a ceasefire, and a release of hostages, moving back of Israeli military presence in Gaza. But, you know, this is not some comprehensive plan in the background, as often is the case, that we're going to see being played out in some, you know, very structured and choreographed way. And it's important that we don't get too far ahead of ourselves in terms of what's going to happen, because there are still very clear differences and uncertainties about where the final destination of this process might actually end up. So I think, you know, the release of hostages and the return of those hostages, the remains of those hostages who are deceased, is one element. There's an element around prisoner release, and there's an element around military withdrawal of some form to agreed positions and so on. But these things have to fall in place before we go any further. And I'm super cautious of getting too optimistic or too far ahead in terms of what we're likely to see actually happen. I mean, are Hamas going to disarm and disband? I'd be very surprised. Is there going to be potential concerns or issues around any Hamas display of strength or behavior that was criticized widely last time, at the point when they released hostages again? That is unclear whether that, you know, I'm going to call it sensible, non-inflammatory behavior is going to be adhered to in relation to that as well. So we are really very early in any process, and I don't think we should get too far ahead in terms of the steps beyond the initial steps. I mean, even who's going to administrate the territory in the early stages afterwards isn't a point of agreement and doesn't seem to be something without some contention as well. So I'm just very cautious. It does feel that things are moving in the direction of a ceasefire, and I'm comfortable with that, and certain steps following a ceasefire. But that's not the same as a peace agreement, and that's not the same as many issues unresolved being resolved or being close to being resolved. I think we're very early on. So I yes, it's obviously positive, but it's not the sort of thing you'd win the Peace Prize for example, so far.
Well, I'm again surprised that Rodney's very cautious about this. I mean, the US is sending its best and brightest to make this happen. Like, Jared Kushner, for example, the president's son-in-law, with him in charge of the negotiations, as well as Steve Witkoff. I mean, it's surprising that that there's so much caution with these guys in charge. I mean, obviously Jared Kushner knows a lot about the Middle East. It's usually in the form of getting funding for his own venture capital fund. And Steve Witkoff also knows a lot about a lot of things like building real estate in New York, but has only recently come into the picture when it comes to the Middle East. So, look. I completely agree. If we're going to be serious, this is baby steps, and these talks that are happening in Egypt with all of these so-called negotiators, a lot of it I think is theatrics. It's for the media. I think there is some level of appetite from the Israelis to, I think, at least with 2 years on from the October 7 attacks to at least move this forward in some way. But there's a lot of uncertainties. There's a lot of unanswered questions. I think President Trump was quick to jump and say that the first phase has been signed. We've, come a long way to resolving a 3,000-year conflict, etc., in his usual way. He's declared victory. But it's certainly very far from the victory. But as I said last week, I think, the optimism in this is that at least we're in a better place than we were, a month ago, where they're talking and there is some sort of plan that all sides seem to be kind of working towards. But as has been the case for 50, 70 years, the devil's in the detail. There's going to be a lot of small details to work through, and it's one thing has been constant in that region, and that is that people disagree on a lot, and I don't think that's changed. In fact, if anything, over the last 2 years, it's probably given both sides, particularly the Palestinian side, a lot to kind of disagree and be grieved about, but certainly the Israeli side as well, in terms of those horrific attacks on October 7. So it's not like the environment is kind of great for something like this, but I think there is an appetite on both sides to stop the senseless killing of innocent people in Gaza. And to have the hostages back, as well as try and come up with something that might resemble some sort of longer term peace plan. I think that's we'll wait and see. It's let's not get too excited.
And I guess any ceasefire has to be followed up with some sort of push towards a Palestinian state, right? I mean, we're seeing so many countries, particularly in the West, push for that to sort of not, I'm sorry, not put, just push for that to recognize Palestine as a sovereign state, which is obviously the ultimate aim of the Palestinian people and their representatives. I don't know if it's the ultimate aim of Hamas and what role Hamas plays in this, but surely this has to lead there. Otherwise, we're back to where we were and where we have been, I guess, for the past, what, 70 years now.
Well, I think, yeah,
Quite
I mean.
possibly. But if people were given the opportunity to wind the clock back and say, can we go back to October the 6th 2 years ago and October the 7th not happen? And I think probably many people would be comfortable with that as an outcome, apart from
Look,
perhaps the Israeli right, who maybe think they've advanced in the region in terms of Hezbollah and Iran and other things, but I don't know. Ozan?
No, I think, obviously, I don't think anyone's really won from this situation. Certainly, the Hamas has been a big loser. Hezbollah has been a big loser. And as Rodney says, for some in the region, they may consider that as a step forward and an important prerequisite before you can have long-lasting peace. That is actually a view that's shared by some people in the region, that peace is not possible with Hamas and Hezbollah pre-October 7 constantly threatening the existence of Israel. So that's been sorted out. The problem you've got, though, is that it's a very different situation. Yes, you don't have those two organizations that have been significantly weakened, but you also have an international community that's very, very upset with what Israel's done and continues to do. There's not a lot of appetite to continue to kind of grant a lot of maybe the potential, the things that that Israel may want, some of the concessions. And also you don't have, if you ask me, a very competent team from the US actually making this happen. Because there's one thing coming to a deal, but as Rodney points out, how will this be administered? Who's going to implement this deal? Who's going to guarantee security for aid organizations? All of this sort of stuff. This requires a significant level of competence, and I'm not sure that exists with the current leadership that's putting all of this together. So, and then the question is, do you have a more radicalized version of Hamas retreating and building up with the support of the usual suspects, and continuing to cause problems, and continuing to mount attacks, etc. So look, it's always been complicated. I don't think October 7 certainly complicated a lot of things in the minds of people. It sorted out a few problems, but I don't think we're in a great place. Certainly not in a place that would make us feel hopeful that it's going to be resolved anytime soon.
Well, it's something that obviously Donald Trump is claiming victory for, or at least claiming credit for, at the very least, of bringing peace to the Middle East. Something that he said that he's always wanted to do, both during the election campaign and then, of course, since the first months of the credit of his presidency is what I meant to say. But another thing that he's, of course, put his mind to over the last few months, and in particular in the lead up to becoming president again, is I guess some sort of revenge or retribution, whatever you want to call it, on the former FBI director James Comey, who, of course, is now being indicted. He's pleaded not guilty this week to two charges of making false statements to lawmakers and obstructing a congressional proceeding. Of course, Mr. Comey was indicted just a few days after Trump urged his attorney general to take action against him. And if you remember back to 2017, he was fired as FBI director about 4 or 5 months into Trump's first term as president. But Rodney, take us through this particular case. What is Comey actually accused of in the US, and what does it mean for, the broader political landscape?
So the charges relate to, or the indictment relates to, evidence that he gave at a congressional hearing, where it suggested that he made false statements with the intention of obstructing the proceedings. And he's been very bullish in terms of how he's responded. There was a long-standing investigation directed by Trump into this particular issue. And nothing was coming of it until Trump then, of course, directed that something, something had to happen, it had to move forward and so on. All of a sudden, a new decision maker is parachuted in, and we have charges or an indictment preferred. He's entered his not guilty plea, and he's, I believe, selected jury trial. I think it's pretty unlikely, unless something new emerges, that he will be convicted. I'm going to be as bold as that at this stage. And the first thing I think we expect to see is some sort of attempt to dismiss the charges on the base of a on the base of a lack of evidence, because these there has to be false statements. It has to be with the right intent, and there are many hurdles to prove evidentially. And it does feel like this case, despite a long investigation, was moved to a charge and court phase with a little bit of haste. That never makes for good outcomes in the criminal justice system.
Well, I understand that it was moved in a few days before they filed the suit, a few days before the statute of limitations was up on September 30th in 2025. So, yeah, I think President Trump urged the Attorney General to do this before or in that time period or window where they could actually act. Look, I think I'm going to touch on the politics of it. I think everything that he has alleged that has been done against him, President Trump is doing to others. So, and not just doing it, but doing it on steroids. If you want to talk about weaponizing the justice system, he's it's not even anymore people kind of reading between the lines or anything like that. He's made it very clear that he's going to go after his political adversaries and people that he feels have done the wrong thing by him in the past. So I suspect this is very much first of many other prominent or high profile people who might face charges. And the reality is it's not, as Rodney said, this could very well get dismissed, or even if it goes to trial, he's very well likely to get found not guilty, etc. But just the whole process of having to defend yourself, the amount of money that would cost, if a trial went on, it sounds like it's going to go on for at least a few months. All of the investigation around that trial, all of the things that you have to do, the things that are probably going to get exposed through discovery and what have you. I don't think Donald Trump is all that doesn't I don't think he cares all that about the result or the kind of merits of this case. It's about sending a message that he's going after his political adversaries. And that seems to be the case when it comes to him threatening legal action on other people. This has just become a kind of a tactic that he has used to have his adversaries and also those who are standing up and resisting some of his actions back off.
It's I mean, what's happening is that he's identifying a list of people that he feels have wronged him previously, and the entire capacity of the state to pore over every little thing that person may or may not have done in the past, to find some criminal transgression, to then use that as a basis to harass and bully. And as you say as well, who's on send a message to others, but by using individuals in this way is deeply, deeply unpleasant. I don't know whether, I don't know whether America cares enough about this either, to really be cross, because it's becoming normalized, and that's a real danger with a lot of these types of behaviors. They become normalized. And if you think about the Attorney General's office or the attorney, there's been so many different points of manipulation around this, to initiate the prosecution in the first place. There's been resignations, there's been people brought in as a interim, state prosecutor or US attorney. It just feels all deeply manipulative and unpleasant. But I don't know whether people care enough about it. Maybe they just think, well, if he's been charged, he must have done something wrong. Let him have a trial and we'll find out what happens. Maybe that's the sort of the public attitude to events like this, rather than some sort of presumption that the president is directing the state to find flaws in the history of people he is very clearly targeting in order to harass those people. I don't know. Any insight, Suzanne, and where American opinions at on this? Or is it just divided along the same MAGA Democrat lines?
I mean, he's throwing red meat to his own base, so they love it. Let's go after Comey. This is the biggest scandal that they've ever seen. Blah blah blah. Like, it's all political. I don't think it's going to change anyone's view or change anyone's vote. But what it does provide is again. Sends a strong message. It provides distraction from his real problems, as we keep pointing out on this program. It's really, the economy is going to be continue being a major problem for him. The Epstein stuff, I think, continues to bubble away in the background, and there's now talk of him pardoning Ghislaine Maxwell, who's the accomplice to David Epstein, who's charged with human trafficking, and various other very serious charges. So yeah, I think it's a distraction, and I don't think whatever happens in as the outcome, I don't think will make any difference. It keeps his base excited. They're going after. MAGA pub or MAGA enemy number one. So yeah, it's exciting for them, but I don't think it certainly doesn't really impact anybody's life day to day. I don't think it's people are sitting around the kitchen table going, "Oh, that Comey. Wonder if he's guilty or not." I think they've got bigger issues to deal with.
One of them, of course, being the National Guard, which has been deployed in so many cities in the US now, Chicago being the latest, of course. Illinois, the state that Chicago is the capital of, is a Democratic state, always a blue state, usually a blue state, and now the National Guard is on the ground there in Chicago, something that Trump has said that he's wanted to do for a while, and lawmakers sort of been opposed to it, now looking to potentially file a court case I guess a judicial process that will start to overturn Trump's decision, or at least have an injunction and to stop what is happening on the ground. We've spoken about this in the past, about how, you deploy troops to any city and of course crime will stop, right? Or crime will start to significantly decrease. That's sort of what comes with it. But Ozan, this is just a continuation of Trump sort of asserting his power, particularly over the blue states, or is it something else?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of things. I think, again, it's a good distraction for him. He continues to kind of press on the strongman image. His supporters love it. Even people who should know better are out there saying, well, the people are not allowing ICE to do its job in these cities. And there's been quite a few protests of against ICE, and the Trump administration's kind of handling of the illegal immigration issue. He did it with Washington, and he could do it with Washington because Washington's not a state. So that was pretty straightforward. And he was making claims around Washington being a war zone. He's made the same claims around Oregon. So Portland in Oregon, and same thing with Chicago. I think it's again, it's chaos. People turn on the television, they see National Guard troops going in. He made this intention clear when he rounded up all of the generals and told them they need to lose weight, and that they were going to go and train in these cities. So it's not again, it's not that he didn't say he was going to do it or this is a surprise, but it's a part of the bigger plan. The plan is to create enough chaos, to create a level of emergency that people go, okay, let's not worry about the usual processes and give Trump the ability or the power to take action in these emergencies that of his own making. Is there a crime problem in Chicago? Sure. Is there some level of discontent with ICE? Yes, sure. There are, excuse me, there are a number of protests going on, etc. But the police force and the law enforcement in both of these cities are saying that they can deal with it, and if they need help, they'll call on federal help. But it's this is more. There's no truth to any of this. It's just another strategy for him to wield power, and go down that path of amassing power through the ability to kind of take over blue cities. And again, he's made it no secret of it. That's his goal, to do that. And that everything else is a secondary. Everything else is a kind of trivial point. He wants to, and his supporters are urging him to do these sorts of things, because at the end of the day, that's what his base wants. So, it's going to be very interesting with the injunctions and the legal cases that have been put in place. Obviously, there's quite a bit of legal uncertainty around whether he actually has the power to do any of these things. And if he does, what that means for the sovereignty of states, which again, sovereignty of states has always been a very big thing for Republicans. They've always, supported that over federal government powers. It will be interesting to see, but I don't. Washington, they fixed the problem, apparently. There's no more crime in Washington. I have no doubt that once the National Guard start, patrolling the streets of Chicago, within 2 weeks, the Chicago crime problem will be fixed as well. Of course, it won't be, but that will be the mantra coming out of the White House and all of the people, all of the spokespersons talking on behalf of Trump.
Well, let's head abroad now and to Asia, where the Japanese could end up with its first female prime minister or even its youngest leader in more than a century, as the party leadership election is set to take place on Saturday. It's the governing Liberal Democratic Party, the LDP, of course, who'll be voting for a new party leader. Rodney, take us through what's happening there.
Yeah, Japan looks set on course for its first female prime minister, and despite economic performance of J Japan since the Second World War, its mass appeal for tourism, its soft power projection around the world of Japanese culture and cuisine, it's been still seen as a very male-dominated and gender-wise unequal society, and therefore it's still a little bit surprising that they're moving, or they have moved in this direction to have a first female prime minister. So yeah, it's exciting in terms of it's a milestone, but as with so many female firsts in heads of state and politics, they tend to be from the right, they tend to be conservative, and they often aren't the type of individual who will progress women's rights and an equality agenda. In fact, they very much go in the opposite direction. Like Margaret Thatcher in the UK and so on was very much on the right and the conservative side, in terms of the UK's first female prime minister. So yeah, it's not we don't have a progressive coming in here. We just have someone who's very much on the right, and on the right of the right. I've been around a long time. Unlikely to be the type of leader who's going to bring people together. in terms of political cooperation. This is a reflection not only on Japan having a first female leader, but also where it sits politically. So yeah, it's a point of interest rather than a point of change. Different gender, same policies.
Yeah, look, I think it's an interesting kind of new path for Japan. Obviously, Japan is at a point where they're looking at strengthening their military. There's a lot of, I think, populism bubbling away under the surface there. So it'll be interesting to see how she channels some of those things. They've already had some issues with some of the more moderate parts of the coalition, having issues with some of the policies. Trump has hailed her as a person of wisdom. So that should tell you quite a bit about about where she's going to take Japan. But yeah, look, I think it's Japan is in a very, as many countries are, with such economic uncertainty and this transitional phase that we're all going through with the economic and political and trade world order, etc. But Japan has some very particular problems around its economy. Japan has one of the highest, if not the highest, aged population. It's obviously not been very open to immigration. So, and they have some serious societal issues. I mean, their birth rates are at record lows. So there's a lot of fundamental and structural problems with the Japanese economy. So it will be very interesting to see how some of those policies address those. There's the ongoing geopolitical tensions, obviously, that Japan's in the middle of, a significant driver for Japan boosting its military for the first time since World War II. And so yeah, I think it could very well go down quite a right-wing path on a lot of these things, and quite a populist path as well, which I think seems to be probably where Japanese politics is, much like many other countries around the world.
Well, speaking of populists, let's jump now to Europe, where a billionaire businessman has won the parliamentary elections in the Czech Republic, Rodney.
Yeah, I mean, we discussed this last week. It's not a huge surprise. It reflects where polling was, and although he fits the populist uniform quite comfortably, he had been prime minister before. Yes, he is a very wealthy individual. Yes, he is on the right. But I think the problem is with Babis is whether in trying to form a government, because he's got the largest party but not a majority, he has to bring in fringe parties on the right who have views on Ukraine, welfare for Ukrainian refugees, NATO, the EU, that are even more difficult to manage. And if we look at Israel as an example, and a very clear example to everyone, and this is not in any way to suggest that Netanyahu is some liberal figure, but one of the difficulties that there has been in Israel in terms of resolving this Gaza conflict over a period of time has been the presence in the cabinet of very right-wing individuals as part of a coalition, and that's where the real risk is for the Czech Republic, and where everyone's eyes should be is who does he have to work with to form a government? It does he then, if he can't find partners, form a minority government, or does he seek to bring in fringe far-right parties to prop him up, and what political currency does he have to expend in order to do that? So yeah, no surprise about the outcome. Babis has been around for a long time, but Yeah, it's what the makeup of the government is that really it's the next phase, and it's going to take a little bit of time to get to that final scene.
Well, let's keep an eye on where that all lands. But just before we go, gents, this week the Nobel Peace Prize is being determined tomorrow. Let's take our picks as to who might be getting it. But Rodney, how does it work? Are there nominees? Do we get to choose from a list? Do we pull a piece of paper out of a hat?
So, former winners, heads of states, parliamentarians, they can all nominate candidates for the Peace Prize. And it is usually announced on the 10th of October and awarded in December. What Trump probably hasn't been told, because no one's maybe plucked up the courage to tell him yet, is that nominations, I think, concluded in January of this year. So all this effort to get a deal over the line in the Middle East by tomorrow probably falls well outside the time frame. In terms of people who've been nominated, it's a 50-year delay on the list of nominees being made public. We only hear about the winner. I'm pretty confident it's not Donald Trump. And I think it's probably going to be an aid organization that's made a significant contribution in one of the many conflicts that's been going on in the world over the past year.
Yeah, the other person apparently who's a front runner is Yulia Navalny. So she's the widow of the late Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny. These two organizations, also this person and that aid organization, are the front runners. Yeah, if you look at the bookies, they've got Trump up there as a bit of a favorite as well. So it'd be interesting to see.
There is no way he's going to win the Nobel Peace Prize. I'm
Well,
going
I
to be
mean,
very uncomfortable next week if he does, but there's
some
no
of us
way.
said that he wasn't going to win the 2024 election.
Yeah, but I didn't. I said he might win the election. I'm saying he's not going to win the Peace Prize.
Or the election before that too,
Yeah,
guys.
I mean, he's been probably
Rory Stewart
nominated enough times.
has better outcomes in calling elections than that.
Yeah.
Oh, the world's a strange place, and we continue to understand it. Jens, thanks so much for your time this week. See you next.
Thank you.
Thanks.